Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, episode 34.
Prepare for takeoff. Guiding you down publishing's dark alleyways.
Rubbing it in, like salt in a wound.
Expounding on the greatness of science fiction and fantasy.
A science fiction writer should try to combine the intimately human with the grandly cosmic.
Hi, this is Tobias Bakel, author of Crystal Rain.
And taking themselves way too seriously.
I've had many, many a giggle over it.
Very dramatic. Very nice.
That sounded really realistic, didn't it?
From the Singularity Audio Studios in San Diego, California, your hosts, Sean and Sam.
Then that's where you cue the cheering.
All right, we're going back to press. We're going back to press. Hello, publishing fans, and welcome to another episode of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. I'm Sean Farrell.
And I'm Sam Wins.
And today we have our first episode since joining Farpoint Media. Hey, how about that, huh?
How about them apples?
How about them apples? And our guest today is Kat Richardson, author of the Grey Walker books. We also have Tobias Bakel, who is going to join us in just a second. But first, how you doing, Sam?
I'm doing really well.
You know, before we started recording, you asked me how my little trip was. I never asked you how your little trip was. Did you have a good little trip?
My trip was awesome. I'm totally a dirty hippie right now. All, like, leg hair and armpit hair. I'm sure you wanted to know that. I went to Montana, and we went hiking and camping, and we're away in the wilderness like mountain people. And it was amazing. It was absolutely gorgeous. It was perfect, perfect weather.
Well, very nice. I was going to say that describing yourself as a dirty hippie is sort of the normal state of things, isn't it? I don't really see where the exception comes into play.
Normally not dirty, just
oh,
a hippie.
True. Okay. No, I'm just kidding there. Well, we are back after having traveled across the globe. Okay, the state, or a couple of states in your case.
Yeah,
anyway.
1,000 miles or whatever, something like that.
And while we were gone, we did join Farpoint Media, which isn't going to affect how the show is recorded or produced in any way. You will just be distributed through them, which is a cool thing for us, because it gives us a little bit more exposure, and it just seemed appropriate since it was listening to Farpoint Media podcast, in Comic-Con 2006, when I first started listening to podcasts, and that's what got me hooked. So I still listen to 4 or 5 podcasts from Farpoint Media, so it seemed the logical and appropriate step.
I agree. I'm excited to perhaps reach out to some new folks. They can listen to me and mock me like the rest of you have been doing for quite some time.
And you can learn more about them if you haven't visited their site already at farpointmedia.net. You will see us on there if you look on the, I think they call it their shows page. It's either podcasts or shows. Then we're listed under the books and teaching category.
Are we listed under the awesomeness category? Yes, we should be.
You know, I'll let them know. But they need to create an awesomeness category.
It should be an all-new category and just have us.
Just us, yeah. Well, okay, that's really lame. But anyway.
Really? I thought it was awesome.
No, it was pretty awesome. So welcome all new listeners who discovered us through Farpoint Media. We hope you'll stick around and check out the old shows in the feed. We have some publishing news for you, quite a bit, actually. So let's go ahead and move on with that. And first, we need to mention a sad note, and probably most of you have heard this already, but it's something that we should mention, which is the passing of Robert Jordan last week.
Yeah, I got back from Montana, and somebody was talking about it in the store, and I was like, wait, what? You're joking, right? I mean, I can't say it was completely unexpected, because he has been ill for quite
some
time.
Yeah.
And I actually saw him at my store, Mysterious Galaxy, a couple of years ago when he came to sign Knife of Dreams. And he was doing pretty well then, but...
Wasn't that his last hardcover?
That was his last hardcover, yeah.
Yeah, that came out Christmas of 06?
I think actually it was 05.
05?
Because it was the same year, it was a crazy year, it was the same year that Gaiman came for Anansi Boys and Terry Pratchett came.
Wow, good year.
And George R. R. Martin came for Feast for Crows, too. So they all came out at the same time. Anyways,
okay.
Crazy year. But yeah, he was doing pretty well then, but I know he suffered a lot of ups and downs and that it was a terminal thing. He just, I guess I was surprised because he seemed to be doing so well last I heard, you know. And,
right.
And he promised folks there at the signing that he would finish the book before he passed away. But, of course, you can never truly anticipate those things. So.
Right, right. Well, you know, and he had a disease that only affects 8 out of 1 million people.
Yeah, it was very rare.
Yeah.
I don't even know what it was called. Do you have that written down, John?
No, and I think I remember not writing it down because I had no idea how to pronunciate it.
Yes.
Pronunciate.
Yes, yeah. We speak it in English.
Yeah. But there are different tributes to him online. If you go to locustmag.com, they have a whole bunch listed there that you can read. So, you know, he's a powerhouse in fantasy, arguably the most influential fantasy author since Tolkien. You could make that argument. You know, Terry Brooks is in that category. A couple others are in that category, but he was definitely one of the...
George R. R. Martin.
George R. R. Martin. But, I mean, you know, Robert Jordan has produced... Well, that's not exactly true. You know, Martin's series he's writing now...
Yeah.
He just came out with book 5.
No, he just came out with book 4.
Book 4, okay. And then Jordan, his last one was book 11?
Yes.
Right? And there was going to be one more.
There was going to be one more. By the way, folks... the word on the street, and this is just what I've been hearing kind of in the publishing industry. Now, I don't know if there's truth. You know, it hasn't been substantiated. His wife hasn't called me on the phone to tell me this. But the word on the street is that he had all of the major plot points written. And that basically we're just going to need somebody to, you know, kind of compile the book.
Right.
Kind of like, you know, Tolkien's son did with The Silmarillion.
And the new Dune books that just came out, which are based on Frank Herbert's outlines.
Right. This last book was based on his notes.
Yeah.
Exclusively. So, but I think it's even more than notes. Like, he actually has major segments, like really important segments written. So it'd be just be kind of, you know, the filling in
right.
between the major, you know, major battles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's, if there is a bright spot in this horrible news, I think that would be it. Because, of course, all of his thousands of fans were, of course, very sad to hear him die, but also incredibly sad because, you know, they've been waiting all this time for the series to be finished and for him to pass before the series was complete was just
yeah
you know, kind of a tragedy.
And, you know, it's his life's work, and he would
yeah.
want it finished. I'm sure he has authors that, I mean, he knew he was sick. He probably has it written down somewhere.
Yeah.
If I do pass before this is done, I would like these authors to be approached. And would they possibly, I would not be surprised at all if he has
yeah, I wouldn't be either. And I hope that's the case. And I really hope they find, you know, the right person or people to do the job. Now, I don't know who that person necessarily would be. I haven't even, when I think about who could do this, I can't even really come up with anyone besides some of the other, you know, really huge fantasy authors that are out there that, you know, could do this justice.
Right.
But I'm sure some good decisions will be made there, and I'm sure his wife will probably have a heavy hand in that. And
well, we do have another topic for publishing news, and it comes from a listener question.
Oh, good. Let's get away from being Debbie Downers. I'm being extra Debbie Downer tonight.
This question comes from Matt, and I actually sent it on to Toby as well. So let's hear what Mr. Bakel has to say, and then we'll throw in our 2 cents.
And now it's time for Ask a Writer with Tobias S. Bakel.
Hi, this is Tobias Bakel for Ask a Writer. This week's question, Matthew asks, my question to you is this. Where do you see the genres of fantasy and science fiction going in the next year, or say 10 or so years? More and more literary writers are using fantastical or science fictional elements, and more genre writers are crossing the age-old genre divides. Of course, we still have the easily identified examples of high fantasy and space opera, but more and more the vast majority of stuff out there seems to fall somewhere in between. Not quite sci-fi, but not quite fantasy, or not quite literary, but more resembling the crazy mutant love child of all three. Do you have any thoughts or prognostications? Matthew, of course, interesting question. I have to wonder, though, if your perception about the age-old genre divides are as strong as you think they really are. In science fiction and fantasy, there's always been a ton of crossing over and bleeding. You know, we've been fighting over the gray areas of what science fiction and fantasy really is for so many decades that a bunch of science fiction writers have said, science fiction is what I point at when I say science fiction. In other words, I know it when I see it. And yet different people I know have different opinions of what it is that they see and what is science fiction. You know, I'm thinking of Campbellian science fiction where people had psi powers or could levitate, you know, or mutants with strange abilities that roamed post-apocalyptic landscapes. I remember reading stories from the were written in the 50s where elves slip into modern-day cities. So genre bending is a really hallowed tradition. I really think that it's been around forever. Now, the literary appropriation of SFNL context and symbology is very interesting. You know, science fiction and fantasy has really entered into pop culture, I think. You know, watch Saturday morning cartoons, the top 100 blockbuster movies, and you'll see that we've really infected the sort of mimetic landscape out there. And it's no surprise to see it appearing in literary fiction. I think that's actually a good thing. Now, as to where that takes us, I really don't know. Science fiction is a very marginal market. You know, combined with fantasy, we represent 5-6% of the market, and science fiction has the smaller share of that 5-6%. You know, compare that to romance, which has somewhere between 50-55%, I think, of the market right now in terms of fiction. So if more literature is picking, you know, if regular literature is picking up our ideas, that's cool, you know, and maybe we can reverse that share, or maybe if we pick up some tricks from the mainstream and appeal more to those readers, or maybe if more of those readers are preloaded with some of the symbols and contexts of science fiction, it'll make it easier to sell them on science fiction books. You know, ultimately, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not that worried about where we're going, because I just read everything I can get my hands on from all parts of the bookstore and just try to write entertaining tales. I think you have to focus on writing what you love and sort of letting the dice fall where they may be, because there are so many different ways of getting paid a lot more for a lot less work than writing something you don't want to. It really is a labor of love, and so I just think that that's where we need to focus and let the chips fall where they may. So once again, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to the next question, and have a good week. Happy writing.
Romance books suck.
You're a cruel, cold-hearted beast, Sean. But actually, I'd have to agree with you. They do suck.
I mean, 50%? I mean, I know they sell a lot because I worked at Barnes & Noble, but we also threw away more romance books than anything else.
Yeah, well,
because they only have a 1 month shelf life, you know. Most of them are series. They're not selling a month. Out of there.
That just adds to their suckitude.
It doesn't.
The fact that they don't last, you know, there's no lasting quality to them would make you want to keep them and sell them to people.
Right. Exactly.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry if you're romance readers, folks. I don't mind a little romance, but yeah, Fabio, not my style.
So, what's your opinion on this subject here? The cross genres.
Oh.
Yeah, we're not talking about romance books.
Yeah, I was like, about Fabio? His long, luscious locks? I don't know. I agree. There always has been a little bit of crossover, but I think I disagree a little bit with Toby in that I think we are seeing a lot more of it today. I've noticed it. I've noticed a trend. I mean, I've noticed there are more and more authors that we have a really hard time placing in the store because they're a little bit of everything. I mean, you look at, say... Preston and Child, who do the Pendergast books. It's a little bit of horror. It's a little bit of mystery. It's a little bit of science fiction. It's a little bit of fantasy, urban fantasy. I think authors are no longer being restricted by genres. Whereas I think before people were, well, what are you writing? Well, I'm writing an epic fantasy and, you know, I have magic, and I have this, and they're really taking risks and trying new things.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of with you. I understand what Toby's saying there. There have always been authors who have been able to get away with doing things.
Sure, yeah.
But I think if you look at the last 20 years or so, you know, global communications and the internet have really opened up our minds to this idea that there are more things out there, that not everything should fit in a box. And certainly we live in a postmodern culture where different cultural elements get blended together all the time. So it would only be natural that that would transcend into literature in different
absolutely.
Ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I love how, you know, kind of science fiction and fantasy has this insidiousness. It's inserted itself into popular culture everywhere. I mean, you look at the major box office movies, and they're all based off of comic books or sci-fi or fantasy novels. People are always astonished, you know, it's like, oh, I saw this great movie, you know, for instance, say Stardust. It was great. It's like, well, have you read the book? Oh, there's a book? Yeah. he's a really prolific author. He's written a lot of really amazing books. You should read it. I mean, Children of Men. People didn't even see that as a science fiction flick, which cracks me up, because it is completely science fiction. But they were just like, oh yeah, it was this great, it was just a really great story about humanity. And it's like, well, that's what science fiction, the best science fiction is.
Right, right.
And so I love it. It's kind of fooling the general public, you know, those people who read those romance novels, into watching and reading science fiction and fantasy.
Well, you know, and authors want to be free to explore what they want to explore, too. And genre boundaries can sometimes restrict you, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I understand that genre boundaries are important because it helps the readers identify what they're getting. You know, and helps the publishers know what they're publishing. But I think readers, too, are looking for things that kind of defy their expectations. And pushing those genre lines is a good way to do that. I have a short list here, just off the top of my head, of mainstream books. And hopefully you'll be able to have... Hopefully you'll come up with a couple as I'm reading this that you can throw in here, too. That are basically they're science fiction writers.
Okay. Sure.
Most famous ones, Michael Crichton.
Yeah.
He's always writing science fiction.
Yeah.
Dean Koontz. You know, his first 20 books were pure science fiction.
Right.
And they didn't sell well at all. It wasn't until he started writing more in the thriller mode, but still with science fiction elements, right?
Right.
Stephen King has written fantasy.
Of course. And he would be one I would definitely list if you hadn't.
Yeah. Right. Diana Gabaldon.
Yeah, you know? Which is funny because some people see those as romances, which they are, but they happen to be science fiction romance.
As well. Yeah.
And that's something to point out, too, is that those romance readers are looking for something new and fresh, and paranormal romance has become a huge, huge genre.
Right.
A huge category. So.
And then, Toby was saying that science fiction and fantasy gets 5 or 6% of the share. Well, those books are doing better and better. Do they get counted towards romance, or do they get counted towards speculative fiction? You know, which do some authors go to romance?
You know, that's a good idea. That's a very good idea. I actually don't know. I mean, we're, you know, science fiction and fantasy, mystery and horror, and we carry paranormal romance. So we classify it, you know, Mysterious Galaxy classifies it as, you know, science fiction, fantasy or urban fantasy. But what do these poll takers... What do they classify paranormal romance as?
And there are more, and I remember seeing books on the shelves over the last couple of years and thinking, oh, that's science fiction, but it's in the literary section, and reading articles with authors who denied science fiction. No, it's not science fiction.
Yeah, like Margaret Atwood.
That's the one I was trying to think of.
The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes.
Oh, it's literature. Well, you know, guess what, folks? Literature and science fiction can be one and the same.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
It's like they don't want their reputations to be sullied by having the science fiction ghetto in their bibliography.
It's true. Well, I think we've talked about the snobbery when it comes to literature, which drives me absolutely insane.
You know, and to be fair, there's a snobbery in any form of writing. There's snobbery in science fiction all over the place. I know what you're saying about they don't want to be associated with us. But then we have to be careful not to twist that and say, well, you just don't get it. We're smarter than you.
Well, it's true, but I guess we don't really need to say that to their face.
Yeah. It can still be true. We just don't tell them that. Shh.
Hey, the smartest people I know read science fiction. That's all I'll say.
So I think we kind of beat that topic to death.
Yes, we did.
Thank you, Matt.
Die, horse, die.
So thank you, Matthew, for that question. Appreciate it. And please, guys, if you have questions you would like us to ponder, we can send them on to Toby or even send them on to from the Editor's Desk segment, which will be returning soon, I promise. Send those in to the email adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com, and we will speculate on things. Okay, we're going to take a break and come back with Kat Richardson right after this.
We were nerds, dorks, geeks. We were shunned, ridiculed, and downtrodden. But we just saw the world differently than others. We were the ones who escaped to our imaginations to make sense of the world around us. We have ever been the dreamers, creators, and seekers of myth, for it is here we look for understanding in our world. Somehow, no matter how bad things got, we were always looking up. Join me, Indiana Jim, for discussion of the latest headlines and hottest topics in the realm of geekdom, from science fiction and fantasy to movies and the music that makes them great, to writing, philosophy, inspiration from history, and the newest geek gadgets. Visit podcast.indianajim.net and explore with me the things that have us looking up to the horizon, the heavens, and beyond.
All right, well, Kat, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks.
Hey, how are you feeling? I know you just got back from a big book tour, right?
Oh, well, I think I'm finally caught up to my sleep, but for the most part, still a little tired. It was great, though.
And what locations did you hit while you were out?
Let me see. We went to San Francisco and Portland, and there was a Seattle event on each end. So I started in Seattle, went to San Francisco, came back up, and then did another one in Seattle on Saturday, which was yesterday.
Cool. Did you hit, what's that one in San Francisco? Borderlands? Is that the one?
Yeah, Borderlands. Alan Beats and his crew of merry nutcases. They're wonderful people. It was a great... It was a great event. They had another author in, a guy named Steve Berman, who's best known for his horror short stories, and this was his first novel. So, you know, we had a nice little mixed crowd of, you know, horror fans and sci-fi fantasy fans, and it's a great shop. So, you know, we had a good time and met their cat, Ripley, who's a sphinx, a hairless cat, which seems really appropriate when you're reading, you know, horror and fantasy.
Did they have any ferrets running around?
No, no ferrets.
No.
They're illegal in California.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Most people don't. But they are kind of science fiction-y sort of animals, you know, being long and thin and curious. So I always expect to see them around science fiction stores.
Well, we'll have to explain that reference later on. But could you tell us about your new book, Poltergeist? And can you tell us about the series in which the book takes place?
Okay, well, Poltergeist is the second book in the series, and it came out the 7th of August. And the whole series is about a professional private investigator located in Seattle. Her name is Harper Blaine. And she dies for a couple of minutes. When she comes back, she can see ghosts and vampires and monsters and the kind of interference zone in which they exist. She's not particularly crazy about this job, but she's stuck with it. She can't get rid of it. And little by little, her clientele gets more ghostly and frightening and bizarre. So in the second book, she's working on a research project. She's hired by the head researcher who's trying to create an artificial poltergeist. He's not really a believer in psychokinetic activity, but he's really interested in the abnormal psychology of his control group. And when they start getting really unusual test readings, he starts to think that someone is messing with his research. So he hires her to find out who's sabotaging his project, and it turns out, no, it really is a poltergeist.
And she has a pet ferret, of course.
Yeah, she does. She has a pet ferret. partially because originally she had a dog, and it turns out that she just didn't have the right lifestyle for a dog, but I still wanted her to have a pet. You know, so the dog moved into her neighbor's apartment next door, and she got a smaller, more compact pet.
Well, and having a ferret in the story certainly gives it a nice little comic relief, you know, because it certainly caught me off guard. I was like, a ferret, really? Okay.
Yeah, well, the ferret has lots of opportunities to be cute, and, you know, she can interact with the ferret a little bit, which most people do with their pets. So we have opportunities to explore her character without her having to talk to another person. Also, you know, I like ferrets, so I figured I would just put one in there because I could. I have two agents, and one of them really hates the ferret, and he said, no, get rid of the ferret. And the other one really loves the ferret, and so there's this running battle between the two agents as to whether the ferret should stay or go.
And who's winning so far, would you say, since you're working on the third book, right?
Yeah, I'm winning so far. The ferret is still with us. I don't expect her to be super ferret and live to be 150 years old or something like that, but right now we still have the ferret, and the ferret is there in book three. And there's actually debate about book four. We're actually in contract negotiations right now for books four, five, and six. So a lot of little details are being worked out about what we're going to do next, and exactly how far the series might potentially go.
Okay, well, let's just go ahead and jump ahead with that, and then we'll come back to the book a little bit. Are you planning on writing or ending book three in a way that ends the series, or is it going to have an arc that's open-ended and needs another volume or several volumes in order to continue the story?
Well, somewhere along the way, the rumor got started that it was a trilogy and was only three books long. But that's not true at all. I originally proposed a five-book initial arc with an open end to which another arc or other standalones could be attached, but they only wanted to buy three initially to see how it worked. So it was supposed to be a five-book arc, and now since they're talking about a total of six books, the big question is, are we going to close off the arc in a particular fashion on book five, or are we going to go in a slightly different direction and leave a different hook? Sort of depends on how my editor feels about what we're going to do to certain characters. When I say we, I mean she and I, because it really does end up being a team effort. She's a great editor, and she gives me a lot of very good advice about what's going to work out, what's going to make the audience, you know, really upset or uncomfortable, and what direction is sustainable and what direction is probably a dead end. I wasn't intending really to write a series with an extremely limited book frame. I wanted to write something that was open-ended, but I left so many questions unresolved in the first book that there had to be some kind of long arc in order to finish all of those off. And as I was looking at it, I said, you know, 4 to 5 books is really as long as you can suspend disbelief on these arcs. So that's what we went for, was 5 books, because at 4 it was a little too short and a couple of things were very abrupt. So 5 turned out to be the magic number in this case. But since it's not necessarily a series ender, and the publisher feels that the series has enough potential that they want to keep it going beyond that arc.
Let's go back to Poltergeist for a second here. And you mentioned earlier the way the book opens up with the professor who's running the experiment. And the action kind of takes place in this room where there's some gadgets in there that are meant to mimic the acts that a ghost might perpetrate. But did you research actual cases like this, or was it just complete invention on your part?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I did a lot of research into the original project, the Philip Project, which was a real case of attempted group psychokinesis. And there's an afterword in the book that explains about that particular experiment in the early through mid-1970s up in Toronto. I also knew a little bit about stage magic and general stage techniques, because I used to work in theater. And I know that you can create some of these effects relatively simply, especially with miniaturized modern technology. So some of it was research, some of it was background information, and some of it was me just kind of extrapolating from what I knew. In some cases, I was able to ask my husband about the electronics and sound things, because he works in electronics and computers, and he's got a lot of background in strange and bizarre technology. So it's sort of a mix of research and balonium.
Are you a fan of shows like The Ghost Hunters on Sci-Fi Channel and things like that?
I don't have a TV, so I'm not a fan of actually anything on TV. When I do watch television, it's DVDs of complete series after they're already done. I think the most recent thing I've been watching is the second season of Deadwood, or, you know, I go back and I watch my old Firefly discs. That's about as far as I go.
Those are always good. Well, I'm kind of the same way. I have television, but I don't have cable, so I either get to watch reality TV or game shows every night, and I'd really not want to watch either one.
No, that's not exactly quality entertainment, in my opinion.
No. Well, you know, it's funny you should say that you don't have a television at all, because when I was reading the book, it definitely had a cinematic feel to me, and I was wondering if you were a fan of The X-Files or if you've been inspired by films that deal with this kind of material.
Well, I watched a little bit of The X-Files when it was first on. I didn't actually have a television, but I spent a lot of time with some people who did, and they were big fans. And I've seen a lot of film. I'm a real big film fanatic. I remember the original Buffy, which was great. And I'm really into old films noir. There's always kind of an unreeling film going on in my head when I'm writing. I've got a great big outline, but I'm trying to think in terms of how things look, how they sound, the overall emotional impact of a scene based on basically the lighting and the set and things like that. So I do think kind of cinematically, but there aren't really specific films that influenced me. There's more like general classes of films.
So what are some of your literary influences?
Strangely enough, I'm actually a huge mystery reader, and I came to science fiction and fantasy a little bit later. So,
well, that is definitely in your book, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Someone sent me a note saying, did you know that you write like Raymond Chandler? And I think he meant it as an insult. And I was very pleased, and I said, thank you very much. I'm glad you noticed. Yeah, Hammett and Chandler were big influences, and I did read a lot of mythology and fairy tales when I was a kid, and then I kind of moved away from them. Later, I came back and read other stories. I read more science fiction at one point. I started to read Asimov, and I started to read Heinlein. And I keep coming and going with science fiction and fantasy. Every once in a while, I'll find something I think is absolutely terrific, and then I'll just stop reading for a while, and then something else will catch my eye. I'm like a magpie. You know, I want the shiny literature. I don't want that funky old stuff. I just want the shiny stuff. I'm terrible.
Mm-hmm. So do you read a lot of nonfiction as well?
Not as much as I used to, although it still read quite a bit. Obviously, I do a lot of research, which includes a lot of history and a lot of science, although sometimes it's kind of pop science, because that way I can get the idea boiled down to something really small that I can think about without having to read an 800-page technical manual. But I do read. I read history, I read science, I read philosophy. Upon occasion, I sit down and read huge amounts of strange biographies of weird people and odds and ends of, you know, whatever happens to be lying around at the moment that seems appropriate.
I have a couple of writing questions for you.
Okay.
Could you tell us about your journey as a writer, when you first knew you wanted to write, and how many years of stuff you went through to get to where you are now?
Oh, boy. Well, I always wrote. My father was an English professor, and reading and writing were just, you know, taken for granted. Of course you read, and of course the extension of reading was writing. I wasn't very good at it initially. I think my first short story was when I think I was 7 or 8 years old, and it was called The Pickle Bush. Obviously, I didn't do very good research. I didn't know that pickles were actually cucumbers. Yeah,
nice.
Yeah. Learn from your mistakes. But I always wrote, and I discovered early on that it was an easy way to make a decent grade, because I could sit down and kind of stuff information in my head and throw it back out in some kind of text form. And even if I didn't really get it, the fact that I could be articulate usually bumped my grade up. And I thought, this is great. This is hardly working. Little did I know. So I went to school and got a degree in journalism, which is not really writing so much as it's regurgitation.
And where did you go to school?
Cal State Long Beach. Okay. I have a degree in magazine editing. Talk about rarefied. Yeah, and from there, you know, I ended up working in all kinds of nonfiction technical fields. And it wasn't very fun. But all the time I was writing little short stories and novels and so on in notebooks whenever I was sitting around at my desk job with nothing else to do. And I would submit them, and I would get, you know, notes back that basically said, not only no, but hell no. And eventually I thought, well, maybe I should give up on this. You know, I'll try one more time with this story. And if it doesn't go, that's it. I'm just going to buckle down and become a full-time nonfiction editor and give up on this writing thing. And that was 2004. I finally sat down and really made a blitz with Gray Walker, and got an agent, and it took us a year of revisions, and then we started marketing the book to publishers and Penguin, actually in the person of the corporate person of Berkeley Ace, said, yes, we'd love to have it. And we said, hooray, will you give us money? And they said, well, yes, of course we'll give you money. How much do you want? And we said, a lot. And they said, well, not that much. And we said, how about a little? And they said, okay. And that was how we got the first book published, Anne Sowards, at then Berkeley Ace, and then they rolled NAL Rock into the same group. So she ended up doing both houses, both imprints, and when they had a hole in the publishing schedule at Rock, for a trade paperback instead of a mass market original, which is how Greywalker was originally going to come out. Anne stood up and said, well, I've got a book that's ready to go right now. We can plug that hole with this book. And so my book came out as a trade paperback instead of a mass market. And I think that was probably a very lucky break for me.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, a lot of luck and a lot of, you know, just pushing foolishly because I was too stupid to stop seems to have marked my career so far.
Talking to writers and editors for the show, it seems that luck plays a large part in getting published, but it's always luck for those who have been working their butts off.
Yeah, I think Thomas Jefferson said, the harder I work, the luckier I get. And that seems to be the case, is that after a while you improve your chances because you just keep on taking chances. The more chances you take, not foolishly, but, you know, with some real drive behind it, the bigger that pool becomes, and eventually someone will say, hey, that looks pretty good. Unless, of course, it really is absolute and total caca, in which case someone will come along eventually and tell you, that really stinks.
Oh, boy, I'm in trouble then.
Well, it's that in-between stage. It's actually the worst when you don't know if it stinks or if it's terrific and you just haven't hit the right set of eyeballs yet.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of people sit for a long time, and it's so discouraging because you think, well, it's not good and it's not bad and nobody loves me. But eventually someone comes along and says, no, no, it's terrific. If you would just, you know, tweak this a little, then we'd be able to use it. But until you meet that person who's willing to say, this is the thing that's stopping you, make this change and everything's fine, you continue to fumble around in the dark.
Yeah, that's pretty much where I am right now in my journey. So
you know, if you know that there is a problem, that's the easiest, you know, start is obviously this needs to be fixed. You know, if you can pinpoint what needs to be fixed or that something does need to be fixed, then you stand a much better chance than happily and obliviously running forward saying, it's perfect, how come no one loves it?
Right. So what is your opinion of creative writing programs? Do you believe in higher education to teach people writing, or do you think that's kind of bunk?
I think it really depends on the individual writer. I only took one creative writing class in my life, and it was awful. That was because the instructor was terrible. But I've seen people come out of creative writing courses with a much greater understanding of what they're doing technically, and that's certainly very helpful. And if you've got a good, inspiring instructor who really suits your mental process, that can help you move past a lot of the silly little technical problems. But it really is a matter of the individual writer. I think in science fiction and fantasy, I've probably met a lot more writers who are self-taught, who learned by doing, or who, you know, just read and read and read and read and asked other writers what they did rather than going into formal education. I think science fiction and fantasy tends to attract people who are very self-motivated and kind of rugged individualists who don't really want to do it the way everybody else tells them to.
And probably the other part of that is most universities, I don't think they do anyways, look very kindly upon science fiction as an artistic art form worth pursuing, you know?
Unfortunately, no. Most of them look on all genre as kind of, you know, the redheaded stepchild, and science fiction and fantasy particularly poorly, which I think is funny since the root of almost all fiction is some form of fantasy. If you didn't sit down and have a wild hair idea about why there were stars in the sky or why that lake was shaped like a giant's foot or what might be going on under the ground, you know, with Morlocks and Eloy, you would never have come up with a story at all. And I think that the imaginations of people as a whole and our desire to strive for something better comes out of our ability to fantasize. So fantasy and science fiction, which to me is kind of a hardcore version of fantasy, seem to me to be very basic to the development of societies and cultures. And without them, we'd be kind of mechanical and boring.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I have a degree in literature, and so much of the mythology we study is basically just fantasy. You know, you have gods and demons and these crazy things happening that, you know, rival Tolkien any day.
And it's so obvious when you read certain fantasy writers and science fiction writers even that they're throwing themselves back to those old roots where they look at our history and our mythology when we were, you know, living in caves or during the Dark Ages when there was no explanation but God for everything. You know, if it was something bad, it must have been a demon, or it must have been your human frailty. You know, and those are all functions of our imagination coming forward. And we continue to draw on that well over and over again throughout fiction and literature. And it's very obvious in fantasy and science fiction, less so in other genres.
Well, looking into your future for a moment here, we know you've got the potentially more books in the Greywalker series. What else do you have inside of you that you want to write and put out there, either in novel form or some other form?
Oh, I've got a couple of other projects kind of hanging around in the back burner. There's a science fiction novel that's trying to find time to get written, and a couple of short stories that are upcoming for anthologies. I also would like to write something that was a little bit more serious, not necessarily literature, but something that had a little bit more weight in terms of the structure and the prose and the ideas that are motivating it. Because as much as I enjoy the Greywalker novels, they are basically light entertainment. But I'm not sure that my craft is up to writing some of the ideas I have in my head just yet. So I'm hoping to kind of hone that craft and get a little bit more polished before I jump onto some of these, you know, more bizarre and heavy-handed ideas. Because if you do them badly, they really just look bad.
Cool. Well, is there anything else you wanted to tell us about today?
Boy, off the top of my head, aside from earthquakes shouldn't have to wake you up at 5 in the morning, and ferrets are cute but smelly.
Yeah,
not a lot.
What was that earthquake that you were telling me about in the email?
Oh, this morning we were rousted out of bed by some violent motion of the boat. And there's a motion that's very typical in earthquakes that comes through the hull of the boat, and then the boat gets thrown around quite violently. And we knew it was an earthquake, we just didn't know where. So this morning I had to get online and figure out where there had been an earthquake of a certain magnitude within the last, you know, 12 hours. And sure enough, there was an earthquake. Well, it would have been very early in the morning for us, but it was in the afternoon for the Japanese on Hokkaido this morning. And the wave propagated through the water and caused a great amount of tossing about here in the marina. So the boat was rattling around very violently. Oh, gee, I guess it was about 7 a.m.
Wow. I had no idea that it would affect the waves if, you know, go across the ocean like that.
Yeah, well, they don't, unless they're big enough to start a tsunami, you don't see them on the surface. But waves still propagate outward, and when they hit shallower water, they'll cause water disturbances. And it's really common in earthquakes of about 5.0 magnitude and up. A couple of years ago, there was one in Alaska, and it was felt as far away as Lake Pontchartrain, but only in bodies of water. So we got tossed around, and people down in Lake Pontchartrain got tossed around, and everybody on the land said, "What earthquake?"
That's so weird. I got to try that sometime. There's an earthquake. Where's a boat?
Quick, where's a boat? Yeah. It's a very strange sensation because the boat tosses around on the water, but since it's tossed, it's tied to the dock, and the dock isn't moving as much, there's this rattling and jangling as the boat tries to pull away from the dock, and the dock just sits there. Hmm. Normally, the dock would move at the same rate, but since it's attached to land, which isn't moving, and the water is, there's a little bit of a battle between the boat and the dock.
Well, Kat, it's been a lot of fun having you on the show today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Sean. It's been great.
The day started just like any other day. Always does. Until I watched one of my closest friends die, right in my arms. Nothing I could do. But his death was a beginning, not an end. And now I've been thrust into a timeless conflict of pyromaniac insects and instant mummification, a war within our very genetic makeup. And when the powers of the ancient world collide with modern technology, no one is safe. Not me, and certainly not you. I'm Dr. Phil D'Amato, NYPD Forensics, and the only way to save myself is to solve the mystery of the Silk Code. The Locus Award-winning novel by Paul Levinson comes to life in this free podcast novel. Journey into the ancient world, witness the wonder of ages past, and join Phil D'Amato in a struggle against forces both ruthless and unseen. Visit www.thesilkcode.blogspot.com to learn more about the author and the novel. And subscribe today at patiobooks.com. Join the battle, witness the wonder, or forever be victim to the awe and power of the Silk Code. Phil D'Amato is ready. Are you? And we are back with more show. Our thanks go to Kat for taking the time to talk with us. And you can find her book right now in the new release section at your local bookstore. Or online all over the place. Or come to our website at adventuresinscifipublishing.com.
Ding! Plug! Plug!
We have some good emails to get to right now. And a long one here from Damien, right?
It is from Damien.
Yeah, who's going to clear up a couple things for us. Take it away.
Damien, I don't know your voice, so I can't replicate it. So I'm sorry. You're going to have to sound like me for a minute. I know you guys were just joking around, but there is no trick or conspiracy behind so many Asimov stories getting on the ballot. The Hugo ballot nominees are nominated by voters from the previous Worldcon, not a committee. Probably more people who vote read Asimov's than any other short fiction venue. It's not totally just, but more people in the core of the sci-fi field pay attention to Asimov's than any other magazine, even though Analog has more readers overall. The magazine's editors have managed to maintain this position since the mid-80s, I believe, and they couldn't have done this without truly publishing a lot of consistently exciting or important fiction. Asimov seems to have maintained its leadership position longer than any other magazine in the field. At the very beginning, it was Amazing, then the Golden Age of Astounding, then Galaxy, then F&SF. Being on the top does give the editors an advantage, but it's still amazing that they've managed to stay on the top so long, with brand new editor Sheila Williams showing no sign of losing that edge. So Asimov's gets the most stories on ballots because it's where the majority of engaged short sci-fi readers go to first, and it generally manages to deliver the goods often enough that it maintains its first top stop status. Thanks, Damien. Good thoughts.
Bam! That's what I'm talking about. That's an email right there. Good
Quite
stuff.
Quite meaty. Yes.
Yeah, good stuff.
Thank you for clearing that up, too. That's what I thought about Worldcon, but then I started to doubt myself. And
I wasn't completely sure. I was circling that same idea, but yeah.
Yeah, then once you start doubting yourself, you're like, am I talking out of my butt? I don't know what's happening. So thank you.
And we did get another comment on the blog also referring to this issue that gave very similar information to what Damien gave. So I think it's safe to say that we got it right.
Exactly.
So thank you guys. Yeah.
And speaking of Worldcon, I would just like to say congratulations, Werner Vinge.
You thought he would probably win, but you weren't sure how the location of the con would affect the final vote.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But he is like voting for the home team.
Yeah, exactly.
I told him he should make a t-shirt that says, I've won blank Hugo's. And that way he
could
just...
Oh, like a little Velcro thing.
Yes, exactly. So he doesn't have to have a t-shirt made every single time he wins a Hugo, since this was, I believe, number five for him. So, yeah.
That is awesome. Maybe we should make that and give it to him this weekend.
That's a good idea.
We'll just like write it on the on a white t-shirt with a Sharpie.
With a Sharpie.
Make him
totally classy with a capital K.
That'll look like a con shirt. I got another email here from John, who just wanted to tell us that he just discovered the podcast thanks to Sam's recommendation.
Oh.
And he's been working his way back through the archive. So he can tell all of you how bad the show used to be. No, I'm just kidding.
Without me, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Once again, I'd like to take this opportunity to point out
how
much you sucked
I am.
Without me.
Thank
yes.
you very much. he says, I have to admit the dynamic between the two of you, that's us he's talking about there, make for a better show. However, perhaps my favorite part of the program are the interviews. Oh, and who does those? Me. Thank you very much. Sean does.
Only because I'm too busy with my very active and popular social life to actually do the interviews.
That would be funny if it weren't so true. Sean does a fantastic job at conducting these things, and I look forward to hearing some more. Well, you got more coming on the way, so that's good.
And actually, I do want to say it's true. Sean is a very good interviewer. I concede. He's probably better than I am.
And then he says, perhaps you'll be able to corner someone at Conjecture, and he will be at Conjecture himself. So, yeah, John, it's not going to be a huge convention. I'm sure we'll see you there. And speaking of Conjecture.
Indeed.
That's tomorrow.
I know. I'm totally panicking right now. I'm like, why did I agree to do this? I'm on a panel with Werner Vinge. I'm on a panel with Larry Niven. It's like, I just ought to wear a really low-cut shirt and bounce and twist my hair. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
That way they won't pay attention to the stuff coming out of my mouth.
Exactly.
I was going to do the same thing. That's funny that you thought of doing that. I should say tomorrow, Friday, September 28th, for anyone who happens to listen to this in, you know, April of 2009.
Right. You know what we're talking about. Good idea.
Yeah. I am doing a podcasting seminar on Saturday, and then I have two panels on Saturday. One is with you and Werner.
Yeah.
On that one together, talking about blogs and podcasting and Wikipedia and all that stuff. Nah, totally blank. I can't remember the other panel I'm doing right now.
And that panel's going to be awesome, everybody. Sean's really excited about that panel that he can't remember.
I know it's good stuff. I just can't remember what it is. And then Friday or Saturday night is the guest of honor interview with Larry Niven that apparently a couple hundred people are supposed to be there for him. So that'll be fun. I'm a little nervous about that.
I'm going to heckle you from the back.
Can I'm sure I hiss? You will. You can. Just do it when Larry's talking, not me.
yeah, right.
Mr. Niven. Sorry. And then Sunday is a fun panel, which is, I'm not a 14-year-old boy, so why am I watching the Sci-Fi Channel?
Oh, I want to be on that panel. I'm jealous.
Yeah, that one's going
to
be fun.
I also wanted to be on the Reading Alien Sex Scenes panel late at night on Saturday night, but they didn't put me on it. I'm very sad.
Well, you should go. Maybe someone won't show up.
Yeah, and I'll just fill in. Hey, yeah. I'll read a sex scene.
You'll have your guest badge on. They'll let you sit
at
the table.
And my low-cut shirt. Right.
Yeah, you'll look like you fit in just fine. So come by and see us, folks, at Conjecture this week in San Diego. Okay, let's go ahead and wrap this up. Do you have any final thoughts you want to say about Conjecture?
I'm nervous, and be nice to me. That's all,
okay.
If you come and see me.
Closing out this show, I just want to thank everyone who donated to the show the last couple of weeks. Your donations help keep us on the air. So if you think we're worth a dollar or two, please consider supporting what we do. And you could also feel free, if you want to support us, to write us a review in iTunes or at Podcast Pickle, my favorite little podcasting directory. And you can find links for both of those at our website, adventuresinscifipublishing.com.
And please send us some feedback to 206-350-5029.
Yeah, we haven't gotten any voicemails for a while now, folks.
I know, I'm feeling very neglected.
Neglected, yeah.
I'm going to go cry in my pillow.
Finish giving them the info before you cry.
Or you can email. Email's okay, too. We can do that.
We like email.
And that would be adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Or, of course, our website, www.adventuresinscifipublishing.com.
There you have it. So if you have some opinions on the things discussed in today's show, let us know what you think. And we will be back soon with interviews with Michael Moorcock, Larry Niven, and hopefully some more folk from the Conjecture Convention, and who knows who else. We've got a big list, so keep checking us out. We'll see you soon, and thanks for listening.
Keep reading.
Music for Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing by Cargo Cult, from their song Dirt. You can learn more about them at magnatune.com. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to a Singularity Audio production. To learn more, please visit www.singularityaudio.com.